41 years old when she died from an aggressive form of cervical cancer in 1951. She'd been getting treatment in the segregated section of Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore. Unbeknownst to her or her family, researchers took a tissue sample from her cervix and quickly realized that these were no ordinary cells. This cell line, called HeLa, for Henrietta Lack, survived and grew and changed medicine, helping to develop the polio vaccine, gene mapping, in vitro fertilization, and helping scientists working to understand cancer and viruses. While Henrietta Lacks' cells have made millions for some researchers, her family has struggled financially. In fact, they didn't know about their mother's cells until years after her death. My guest science writer Rebecca Skloot tells this remarkable story in her new book, and it's called The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. Rebecca Skloot joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. Congratulations on the book, and it's great to have you in the studio.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Let's start with Henrietta Lacks, and the woman that I learned about in this book was a good person, well-loved, seemed like a loving person herself.
Yeah, it's sort of great. You know, her family, they're some deeply religious, sort of spiritual family, and they very much believe that part of why Henrietta's cells have been so great for science is because they're Henrietta. Right. Like, she was always taking care of people. She would take in cousins who didn't have a place to stay. They would sleep on her floor. She would cook for everyone. So she was this incredibly caring person. And, yeah, so in a lot of ways, her family's like, well, it makes sense that her cells have done so much great stuff. Have done all this good
for the world. Now, she grew up on a tobacco farm in a place called Clover, Virginia, and you went to Clover. What does it look like today?
I did. Well, unfortunately, today it's actually pretty much gone. When I first started going there in the 90s, it was just this sort of fallen down shell of its former self in a very tiny town that used to be a bustling tobacco town. There's one little main street that has about a block long that used to have, you know, hardware stores and banks and all sorts of stuff. When I was there, the buildings were there, but they were pretty much falling down. And then over the years that I was working on the book, at one point I went back for a visit and everything was just gone.
Wow.
It had just been leveled.
Wow.
But this area where Henrietta grew up, they called it Lacks Town because it was essentially, it was part of what was once this plantation that was owned by a man named Benjamin Lacks. And at some point the land got divided and he gave half of it to his, you know, the children who he'd had with some of the former slaves, and then he gave the rest to the white Lackses. So there, to this day, there's this sort of road down the middle, and on one side there are black Lackses, on the other side there are white Lackses. And on the black Lackses, they still, a lot of them live in these old sort of slave era shacks.
So she farmed the land of her slave ancestors in Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
Now she married, this, it gets complicated, but she married her first cousin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when Henrietta was about, I guess she was about four, her mother died in childbirth. Henrietta was one of 10 kids. And her father, Henrietta's father, shipped all of the kids off to live with various relatives in Clover because he couldn't take care of them. And so they sort of got distributed, and she ended up at her grandfather's house where another cousin had been left by his parents who couldn't raise him. And he was about 5-6 years older than her. And they were raised together as children, just as siblings. And then, you know, at some point, they started having babies together. Mm. And they just, I think it was just never even a question. Just sort of assumed that, oh, then they would get married. And so she spent her whole life with him.
And he moved first to Baltimore, and then she followed, and that's where they lived. And she was diagnosed with cancer. And it sounded like a very aggressive, virulent form of cervical cancer.
Yeah, it was incredibly aggressive. you know, her doctor is actually still alive today. He's 99 years old, and he has this incredibly vivid memory. And, you know, I've been talking to him. I've been working on the book for about 10 years, so I've spent a lot of years talking to him. And he has said again and again, you know, I saw thousands of cervical cancer cases in my career, and I never saw anything like this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it looked strange visibly. It was a funny kind of purple color, and it just grew so incredibly fast. It was about the size of a nickel when she was diagnosed, and she was 30 at the time. And then within about 6 months, nearly every organ in her body was replaced by tumor. And she died not long after she turned 31.
Now, she was treated, and you describe, and again, this is 1951. She was treated with radium. And I have to say, your descriptions of the treatment for cervical cancer using radium was jaw-dropping in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it's really, it does sound so shocking. So what they did was they took these tubes of radium, which is radioactive material, and literally sewed them to the surface of the cervix in little pouches. And this stuff was very, very radioactive. And so it would essentially just sort of burn off the cancer. And then after that, they would remove the tubes, and then they would get radiation, sort of like what we have today, the external radiation. But, you know, in the 50s, this was all not a perfect science yet. And so the levels of radiation were higher than we use now. And so, you know, she did have some pretty bad burning from some of the external radiation. And the internal radiation is still something that's done, you know, like in prostate cancer. They use those little seeds that they put in the prostate. And so it can be a really great way to really sort of effectively deliver radiation somewhere. But you know, they don't use radium anymore in that way. I mean, it was sort of like, you know, blasting the cancer away.
But was that standard care at the
Absolutely.
Time? Or considered, this was standard care?
Yeah, it was actually considered to be the sort of top of the line. There was a bit of debate about what was the best way to treat it. But yeah, this was considered the best thing you could do for it.
Now, she and her family lived in Baltimore, and she got care at Johns Hopkins Hospital there in the so-called colored ward, or the segregated section of the hospital. How did that compare to the white section of the hospital?
Yeah, there have been a lot of sort of studies about how segregation affected healthcare delivery, healthcare outcomes. And, you know, across the board, it seems like, you know, not just at Hopkins, but everywhere, that, you know, patients seen in black wards were treated later in their disease process. They didn't get the same kind of pain medication. They often were hospitalized much later. And, you know, there's no real way to know how that affected Henrietta's care.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at her medical records, you can't really sort of see that. But, you know, there was a point where, I mean, she was sent home repeatedly, and to the point where she was in a lot of pain at home. And she went back to Hopkins at one point and said, I need to be checked into the hospital now. And they did, and that was very shortly before she died. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think it's a legitimate question to say, if she'd been white, you know, would she have at least had better pain management, and would she have been in the hospital? She would have. Her cancer was so aggressive, she would have died either way. But
well, and one of my questions, and maybe there isn't an answer to that, did she die of the treatment or the lack of treatment or from the cancer?
Oh, but absolutely from the cancer.
From the cancer, just because how aggressive, yeah, and I guess uniquely aggressive this cancer was.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and there are a lot of questions about why, you know, her cells grew as aggressively outside of her body. And so there seemed to be something about her cancer that was just sort of special. And there are a lot of theories about that. Nobody really knows why.
Hmm.
So I've heard various theories. You know, she had HPV, which is the virus that causes cervical cancer. She had multiple strains of it. And so, you know, some people have said, well, that combined with the fact that she also had syphilis could have, you know, weakened her immune system and made it grow very powerfully. Just last night, actually, I was with a group of clinician scientists at Jefferson, and one of them said, I think it was probably that tumor was actually a metastasis from something else, probably aggressive breast cancer. And that, looking at her, it's interesting now. So scientists are reading this and seeing her history and saying, well, maybe this, you know, maybe it was already metastasized, and what we saw in her cervix was just one part of that. And, you know, it's an interesting theory. No one has come up with that yet, so who knows? It's interesting to see where scientists are going with this. I think maybe we may learn more about her cancer now.
As time goes on and mm-hmm. this information is out there. Doctors, though, at Johns Hopkins took tissue samples from her cervix. Mm-hmm. They did it without informing her. She didn't know. Her family didn't know until many years after her death. Again, unusual at the time?
Totally standard. Yeah, so at the time, you know, this 1951, the pap smear had just been developed a few years earlier, and there was this big effort to figure out how to use it. So we had the pap smear. There was still a lot of misdiagnosis because doctors would take samples from the cervix and look at them under the microscope, and they didn't really know what they were looking for. So they would sometimes see a bacterial infection, think it was cancer, and give the woman, you know, radiation, and she didn't even have cancer. Or the other way around, they would see cancer, think it was bacterial infection, give her antibiotics. So there was a lot of misdiagnosis. And at Hopkins, this one researcher set out to essentially prove what was cervical cancer and what wasn't. Mm. So he was trying to grow cervical cells to do that, to basically stop the misdiagnosis of the disease. At the same time, scientists all over the world were trying to grow an immortal human cell line to use in all kinds of research. And they figured if you could have human cells growing outside the body, you could do things to them that you couldn't do to people. And you could sort of study drugs, and you could learn about what cells actually are, how they work. You know, we didn't even know what DNA was at the time.
That's amazing.
So nationwide, people were taking samples from people without their knowledge and trying to grow them. At Hopkins specifically, they were taking samples from any woman with cervical cancer who walked in the door.
So not just in the so-called colored wards or anything. I mean, is there any way to know whether those patients were more likely to have their cells taken?
Right. They probably, they probably were, only in that's where the majority of patients at Hopkins, in the wards where this was happening. So the public wards were, you know, where black patients went because they couldn't get treated anywhere else, and where the poor people went because it was free. So absolutely, it was happening more to that population because they were the ones there.
Now, her cells, and the way you write about it, and you talk to a lot of people involved in the evolution of these HeLa cells, is it very quickly they saw that they were just different.
Yeah.
They behaved differently. They grew quickly.
Yeah, just within days of putting them in culture. And all, you know, so many other cells had just died right away, or maybe lived for a day and then died. And even those that lived, they didn't really do anything. They just sort of sat there. And hers just took off. They doubled their numbers every 24 hours. And his lab assistant would, you know, they would fill the dishes that they were in, and she would split them into more, and then split them into more and more and more. And pretty soon they were just sort of all over the lab.
And this is
Dr. George Guy.
George Guy,
yeah.
Who was a researcher at Johns Hopkins.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and his assistant, Mary Kubitschek, who was actually the one who did all of the work in the lab.
And so for them, this was this one of those, I won't say aha moments, but just a moment of realization that these cells could help advance understanding of medicine and disease.
Yeah, and they knew that if they could get an immortal human cell line, is what they call it, something that can just grow indefinitely in the lab, they knew if they could get one of those that it would be huge for science. And so there were a few days where George Guy was sort of hesitant, and he was like, well, maybe this is a fluke, they're going to die, but they didn't. Mm-hmm. And then he just started telling all of his friends and colleagues, like, hey, guys, I think maybe we have this immortal human cell line.
And that's what they called it, immortal.
Yeah, that's the sort of scientific term for it, is that it's immortal. And the response from scientists was, great, can we have some?
And he gave a lot of these cells away.
So he just started sending them to any scientist who wanted to use them for research. And today you can order cells online and ship them by mail. But at the time, he would actually go to airports with tubes of these things and convince pilots and flight attendants to put them in their pockets, to take them to whatever destination he wanted them to go, and then scientists on the other end would grab them and run back. And then they would give it to their friends, and that's how they started to spread.
Let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation with science writer Rebecca Skloot. We're talking about her new book. It's her first book, called The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. And just reading the cover here, doctors took her cells without asking. Those cells never died. They launched a medical revolution and a multi-million-dollar industry. More than 20 years later, her children found out their lives would never be the same. We're going to pick up on all of that after this very short break. Stay with us. You can also give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Now through April 11th, the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts presents The Graphic Unconscious, the five-venue core exhibition of Filagraphica 2010, Philadelphia's international festival celebrating the print in contemporary art. Featured artists at PAFA include Mark Bradford, Arid Hofschi, Kiki Smith, Popone Osorio, and other renowned artists who treat conventionally recognized mediums in new and imaginative ways. For details, 215-972-7600 or pafa.org. PAFA supports WHYY.
You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. It's 11:20. We meet a man who turned the loss of a job into the opportunity to pursue his lifelong passion.
I was terrified. It wasn't going to work. It was going to be a failure. It was getting into something that was so totally different than everything I'd done for the first 30-some years of my life that it seemed like a huge mountain to climb.
This coming-of-age story coming up at 12:30 this afternoon. You're listening to WHYY-FM.
While sitcoms like Father Knows Best, Leave It to Beaver, and The Cosby Show highlighted traditional families, writer Rebecca Walker says not all families look like that, and that's okay.
I really want to support the families that are making different decisions and finding new ways to love each other.
Rebecca Walker talks about her new anthology, One Big Happy Family. That's next time on Tell Me More.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Our guest is science writer Rebecca Skloot, and her book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, is the extraordinary story of a poor African-American woman who died 60 years ago and her cells launched a medical revolution. The book has gotten rave reviews and raises lots of questions about things like informed consent, about race, class, science, and medicine. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. So describe this revolution that got launched by Henrietta Lacks's cells.
Well, it started with the polio vaccine. So in 1951, when she died, it was one of the worst points in the polio epidemic history. There was this big effort to come up to find a polio vaccine. Soon after, Jonas Salk discovered the polio vaccine, but needed to test it in order to make it available to the general public. One of the first big things her cells did was that they were used to test the polio vaccine on this enormous scale. They set up a Gila factory that produced literally 3 trillion cells a week at the Tuskegee Institute, so that those cells could be sent out to these polio centers. So that was the first big thing. And then from there, the range of things done with her cells was just astonishing. They were sent up in the first space missions to see what would happen to human cells in zero gravity. They were the first cells ever cloned, the first cells ever frozen, which is actually a huge deal with science. You know, the idea of finding a way to freeze and thaw cells without harming them. You know, IVF depends on that, stem cell research. Hers were some of the first genes ever sequenced. Some of our most important cancer medications started with research on her cells, including like vincristine and tamoxifen, which, you know, at this point, pretty much everyone knows someone who's taken those drugs. And so the range of things that her cells have been involved in is just enormous.
Does anyone know how, I mean, is there a number for how many cells were, in a sense, reproduced from these original cells from Henrietta?
It's sort of incalculable, but yes, there have been estimates. So one scientist actually calculated that just based on the number of times her cells can divide and all of that, that if you could gather all of them together on a scale,
gather all of her cells that
could have possibly grown from that first sample, that they would weigh more than 50 million metric tons, which is more than several hundred Empire State Buildings. I mean, it's just sort of inconceivable, because cells weigh nothing.
Sure.
A long time ago, someone calculated that if you laid them end on end, they would wrap around the Earth at least 3 times. And that was a long time ago, so it would be many more times by now. So, you know, we can't really know, but the scale of it is just sort of unfathomable.
So her cells, these HeLa cells, are still being used today?
Oh, yeah. They're still one of the most common cells. I mean, pretty much any laboratory where you do cell culture, there's going to be some HeLa cells in the freezer somewhere.
You also tell this, and there are two parallel stories. One is about science and medicine and all the breakthroughs that have come from Henrietta Lacks's cell. The other is the story of her family.
Right.
And again, she was not told that her cells were being used, nor were her children. They didn't learn until many years after her death. And her children, frankly, after she died, were taken care of by a cousin and sort of hard to know exactly what, but anyway, but by a family member. And as you describe it, really mistreated.
Oh, yeah. The sort of brutality that her kids experienced after her death was really, it was a surprise to me when I was researching the book. I, you know, didn't know anything about the family's story when I set out to do this. I was interested in the cells and the woman they came from, but yeah, they were horribly abused, physically, sexually. And, you know, it's all part of the story. It's part of this immortal life of Henrietta Lacks. You know, the loss of Henrietta was so harmful for her family in so many ways. And she was the one sort of woman in the family. So her daughter, Deborah, was raised by a lot of men and in some pretty harsh situations. And she just was the one person who was the big caretaker for everyone. So when she went away, everything sort of fell apart. Her kids got tuberculosis from a cousin, right, like literally within weeks of her death, and one of them almost died. And I mean, the impact of her death on the family was amazing.
They also didn't talk about, I mean, in right. a certain, after she died, no one really talked about Henrietta Lacks in this family.
Right, absolutely. And so her kids didn't remember her at all. They ranged, when Henrietta died, they ranged in age from just a few months old to, her oldest was 16, but he was so traumatized by all of it, he doesn't remember anything of his childhood. So he doesn't remember her. And the younger kids, who were all basically toddlers to, you know, and younger when she died, have no recollection of her. And no one talked about her. They didn't tell stories about her. So they didn't know anything about her as a person, but they also didn't know why she died. So she just sort of vanished in the way that they saw it. And then, so in the early 70s, when a group of scientists decided that in order to learn more about the HeLa cells, they would track down her kids and do research on them. This was the first they'd ever heard of anything having to do with their mother. So the thinking was, this was the early days of gene mapping, and these scientists thought, if we can get some DNA samples from her kids, we can use them to study HeLa. And so this one scientist called her husband up, and her husband had a third grade education. He didn't know what a cell was. And the way he understood the phone call was essentially, we've got your wife. She's alive in a laboratory. We've been doing research on her for the last 25 years, and now we have to test your kids to see if they have cancer, which wasn't what the scientist said at all. They had no interest in treating the family. This was not therapeutic for the family in any way. It was just for research. But for the family, it made sense. So Deborah, at that point, was 26.
And this is the daughter.
The daughter, right. And so she had lived her whole life sort of in fear of her 30th birthday because she knew her mother just sort of died spontaneously. There was no sort of story behind it. And so she figured she would die too. And so she thought, well, it makes sense that the scientists have come back now. And so her family got sucked into this world of research they didn't understand. And you know, they would call Hopkins wanting their cancer test results, and then they would never hear back. And then word got out that someone had access to the family. So other scientists started saying, hey, can you get us some samples? And so samples from her kids started being sent out sort of on a smaller scale, but similarly to what happened to the cells. And that... Right, was a source of a lot of problems.
And one can imagine, and again, you know, on the one hand, you've got this evolving, this developing medical scientific knowledge based on this woman's cells, and you've got families struggling with the death of their mother, struggling financially. They didn't even have health insurance.
Right, and still don't.
Yeah,
and there were sort of two things that were really painful for the family. And the money was a big one. So, you know, Henrietta's cells, in addition to being so important for science, they were the first cells ever commercialized. So the first company that ever started out selling human biological materials was selling HeLa. And today, it's a multi-billion dollar industry. I mean, we can trace some of our biggest companies back to this one little company that started off selling HeLa. So when her sons found out about that, they were furious. They were like, what do you mean someone's buying and selling part of our mother? And not only do we not get some of that money, but we can't even go to the doctor and get access to these amazing things she supposedly helped do for science. Mm-hmm. And so that was a source of a lot of anger for her sons. For Deborah, it was more of an emotional response. So she very much believed that her mother's soul was alive in these cells. She referred to them as her mother. They were not her mother's cells. They were her mother. And she had spent so much of her life sort of holding up her mother as this person who, if she'd only still been alive, she could have helped and stopped all this bad stuff that happened. And so for her, she was very concerned about, you know, this idea of, you know, can Henrietta rest in peace if the scientists are, you know, sending parts of her to the moon and injecting them with chemicals that sound like they might hurt. And you know, so she had a lot of sort of really big existential questions about that.
Well, and interestingly, she was a woman of faith. Mm-hmm. And you describe yourself as being sort of a religious. You worked hard to try to win her trust. You wasn't sure. This book took you about 10 years to write and get published, but she kept putting you off. She was ambivalent. Could she trust you? You were a white woman. She's an African-American woman. Then you've got, obviously, all this history that's folded in. Why do you think, in the end, she decided to trust you?
She always used to say that she did it just to make me go, like, just because I was driving her crazy.
Away.
Yeah. But I don't think that's actually true. So it took me about a year and a half to convince her to even talk to me. And once I started really learning, I mean, and her resistance to me is part of what led me to really uncover what happened to the family, because it was obvious she was very scared. Something bad had happened and I didn't know what. And so as I did research, I mean, the one thing that was very clear to me was she wanted to know who her mother was. And so as I did my own research, and I would go down to Clover where her mother was raised, and I would find her cousins and siblings and learn about Henrietta's childhood and stuff, I would call Deborah's answering machine. She would never pick up the phone. She had caller ID. So she always knew
she
it was
you.
Yeah, right. And she would just, I would leave these stories on her answering machine. You know, your cousin Cliff just told me this great thing about your mom. And I did that for a long time and just basically said, I'm not trying to hide anything from you. And if we do this, you can learn about your mother too.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Rebecca Skloot, our guest today on Radio Times. She's a science writer, and she's got a new book. It's her first. It's called The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, and it's about an African-American woman who died in 1951. She died from a virulent form of cervical cancer. Her cells were taken from her body without her permission, and those cells literally launched a medical revolution. And our guest, Rebecca Skloot, tells both this scientific medical story, but also tells the story of Henrietta Lacks and her family. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Your research and your contact with the family also got you into their view about science, about medicine, about health. You've got the Tuskegee experiments, which, of course, have, I think, influenced a lot of African Americans and how they feel about the medical community, and a lot of fear, a lot of paranoia about care. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, what they told you or what you found.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. The story of Henrietta Lacks has long been held up as another Tuskegee. You know, the story as it's been told is, you know, this racist white scientist who knew this black woman's cells were valuable, stole them from her, maybe didn't treat her cancer so the cells would grow. And none of that's true.
And this is George Guy.
That was George Guy, right. And it wasn't the case at all. You know, he didn't even know she was black initially. I mean, we sort of talked about the fact that obviously her race did play a role in the fact that she was at Hopkins at all. But the family, you know, it really... So they had heard about the Tuskegee studies where, you know, African-American men were essentially not treated for syphilis while they were being studied, and sort of is the most famous case of sort of racial injustice in science. But there's a long history of other things. You know, her family was raised, they have this sort of line that they always say, which was, you know, you do not go outside after dark in their neighborhood, which is right near Hopkins, because Hopkins will snatch you off the street and do research on you.
These are the night doctors, right?
And right, so this is this idea of night doctors. And it's a very common belief, not just among the Lacks family, but widespread in the black community around Hopkins, but also other hospitals. And some of that, you know, some of it is based in fact, you know, the idea of night doctors started in sort of slavery times when a lot of slaves were used in research, pretty brutal research, without their consent. And slave owners would often say to their slaves, you know, if you go outside at night, you know, the night doctors are going to take you and do horrible things to you. And this was a way of controlling their slaves to make them not run away. And then as time went on, there were, you know, a lot of cases of, you know, body snatching. And there were some cases where, you know, there was something called burking where... people were literally basically, you know, taken off the street and used in research. Very rare, but it did happen. And, you know, and so all of this fed into this oral history, which is so rich in African-American mm-hmm. communities. It sort of combined with the stories from slavery times and was passed down. And then, you know, Hopkins in particular had a few cases where, you know, they had a lot of, you know, sort of issues and bad press surrounding the fact that they did some research that was questionable with African American communities, and so all of this kind of came together, and Henrietta's story got sort of sucked up in that.
But you're saying that the story of Henrietta Lacks is not like the story at Tuskegee, because she got care, right?
Right. So, you know, she did, right, she got care, and it was, you can't take race out of the story, but this didn't happen to her because she was a black woman and a white person was doing something bad to her. Of course, the fact, you know, there are a lot of questions about how race played in, and also with her kids, you know, they, you know, a lot of the story, their story is about the fact that they didn't have access to education, and they were, you know, an impoverished African-American family living in, you know, East Baltimore, which, you know, so their situation would have been very different if they'd been black, or if they hadn't been black.
You spent a lot of time with this family, got to know them. They now know the story of their mother. What do they want?
Well, it sort of depends on which generation you're talking about. Her kids want health care. They want, you know, I think at this point they're less angry than they were when I sort of came along and we started doing this. because at least now they understand what happened and they appreciate the complexities of it a little bit more. And they're sort of proud of her. You know, they think that what she did, her cells did for science is great. But at the same time, they are still pretty angry about the way they were treated. Mm-hmm. And a couple of her sons are, you know, still very much holding out for, you know, when somebody going to come and tell us that we can now go to the doctor or we can.
And has someone come forward to say, I mean, either part of the scientific community, the medical community to help this family?
No, nothing like that's been done. I mean, I, you know, as a sort of writer coming into this, I was concerned about being yet another person who sort of came along and benefited from the family without doing something in return for them. So I set up the Henrietta Lacks Foundation, which is online at henriettalacksfoundation.org, and some of the proceeds of the book are going in there, and anyone is free to donate. I've been encouraging scientists, you know, anybody who's benefited from her cells, which is pretty much anybody,
sure,
can donate there, and that foundation is primarily for scholarship funds for any descendants of Henrietta Lacks so that they could go to school, and also I hope if it works out sort of financially to help them with healthcare, you know, and it has sort of a larger mission, this idea that I have sort of grandiose plans that someday it will be so big I'll be able to offer, you know, it'll offer scholarships for any African-Americans who want to study science. But so that's there, but mm-hmm. So far it's, you know, it's just sort of me.
You described taking Deborah and her brother back to Johns Hopkins, and there was a researcher there working with herself to literally show them their mother's cells.
Yeah. Yeah, he was. He responded to an article that I wrote.
This is the researcher.
Yeah, the researcher in 2000, so a very long time ago. And his reaction has turned out to be, I think, the predominant reaction among scientists, which was, you know, was essentially, oh my God, you know, I have been working with these cells my entire career. I did my PhD dissertation on these cells. Everything I've done that has advanced my career has been thanks to her cells, and I had no idea. I never stopped to wonder who they came from. I never wondered whether she'd given consent. Like, their HeLa cells are just sort of omnipresent in labs. It is like there's the test tubes, there's the fruit flies, and there's HeLa, and people don't stop to think about them or any of the other samples. So really, he contacted me and said, I would really like to do something to thank the family. I feel horrible. And so he happened to contact me at a time when I was looking for someone who could show them the cells in a lab and really walk them through it. So we went in and some of her kids got to see the cells for the first time, which was huge. And he said, you know, thank you and I'm sorry, and sort of really took time with them.
And what did they look like? I mean, what did you, and we're almost up in a rake here, but what did you see or what did they see?
Well, the cells are gorgeous. They're really, you know, some of it depends on how you stain them and what, but they're just very vibrant and multicolored, and they look like sort of a universe, like a galaxy filled with lots of shooting stars and colors, and they're really, yeah, they're beautiful, and that was really great for her kids to see.
Let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation with science writer Rebecca Skloot, and we're talking about her new book called The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. And any questions or comments you might have, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And this book tells an extraordinary story. It also raises questions about things like informed consent and race and class and science and medicine. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the University of Pennsylvania's Clinical Doctorate in Social Work program. Are you a master's-level social worker? Have you ever thought of pursuing a doctorate and felt that your options were limited? The program enables social workers to earn a doctoral degree in just 3 years without career disruption. More information can be found online at sp2.upenn.edu/dsw or 215-898-5550.
It's 11:40. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. When the U.S. Supreme Court threw out the ban on corporate spending for candidates, both advocates and critics described the decision as momentous. Ahead at 2 this afternoon on Talk of the Nation, listen for a guide to the new era of campaign finance. Today's forecast, snow showers that could deposit up to 1 inch of snow accumulation on Philadelphia streets, high around 35 degrees. This is WHYY. We'll be right back.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We'll have a conversation about science and faith with openly religious Dr. Francis Collins, the director of the National Institutes of Health. Also, 16-year-old violin prodigy Sam Weiser. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, and again, Rebecca Skloot is our guest, and we're talking about her new book of The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about even just how you got into this story. You were a 16-year-old, I think you were at community college or a local college, taking a science class, and the professor put her name, Henrietta Lacks's name, on the board and kind of erased it and said this was a black woman and sort of end of the story. And that was the little seed that got planted?
Yeah, so, right, and I went up to him after class, and I now know it was very unusual for him to know her name. Most scientists out there and most textbooks say that the cells came from a woman named Helen Lane, which was the pseudonym that had been out there for many years, sort of thrown out there to kind of throw journalists off the track of finding the family
in the 50s. These are the HeLa cells.
Right, the HeLa. Right, so they're H-E for Henrietta and L-A for Lacks. So there were several other names that were H-E-L-A, including Hedy Lamarr at one point.
Oh, my goodness.
So the fact that my teacher knew her name at all was very strange, and also that he knew that she was black. And it just really grabbed me, and I went up to him after class, and I said, you know, what else do we know about her, and did she have any kids, and what do they think about this? And he just said, you know, we don't know anything. And he said, you know, if you want to go do some research, you know, see if you can find anything, do a little extra credit thing, you know, turn it in, I'll give you a few points. And I actually, a few months ago, I sent him the finished, you know, the pre-publication version of the book, you know, essentially with a note that said, Mr. Deffler, here's my extra credit paper. It's about 20 years too late. But, you know, and I think I've done a lot of thinking about why that moment grabbed me. And And there were a lot of things sort of going on in my life at the time. My father is sort of, we refer to him as my famously brain-damaged father. He had a viral infection that caused some pretty severe brain damage, which he's written about. He's also a writer. And that happened when I was 16. So that was that same year. And I was, you know, it was a very sort of scary time. He went from being, you know, my marathon running sort of super dad to being this completely incapacitated. He couldn't walk up and down stairs, and he enrolled in an experimental drug study, and because he couldn't drive because of the brain damage, I would drive him to the hospital four times a week for these infusions of these drugs, and he was all bruised, and I was sort of watching him and all these other people involved in the study. And I think, you know, sort of now that I look back on it, I think as a 16-year-old, I was sitting there sort of being terrified for my dad's life and seeing people doing things to him, and he wasn't getting better. And there was this big hope that this was going to save him. A lot of disappointment because there were some ethical questions about the study. And so I think, you know, I had all of this was going on. And I think that's why when I heard about this, my first question was, did she have any kids? Yeah. And what did they think about it? And I think it's because I was a kid watching my own father be used in research.
And it seemed, as you wrote about Deborah, one of Henrietta Lacks's kids, you seemed to, I mean, finally she allowed you into her life. And it seemed like there was a pretty powerful connection of two girls, women, who I was going to say love, but also just, you know, had issues with their parents, you know, your dad, her
right.
mom.
Yeah, no, there was we were a very unlikely pair, and we just, even us sort of going around together, you know, part of the story is essentially this travelogue, and part of how I really won her trust and convinced her to talk to me was that I said, hey, you can come with me when I do my research. I'm not trying to hide anything from you. So we would travel around, and, you know, she had no interest in going into archives and doing the boring stuff. She was like, you go do that and then come tell me about it. But, you know, so we did a lot of traveling together, and we developed this very complicated, strong relationship where, you know, part of it was that I was teaching her things all the time. I was, you know, sitting down with basic biology books and saying, this is what a cell is. And, you know, she would say things like, she very much believed scientists had cloned her mother. Because if you go online and you search for Henrietta Lacks and clone, you get thousands of hits. Wow. You know, and we would sort of, you know, I'd say, no, Deborah, they didn't clone your mother. And, you know, we would sort of go back and forth about this. And sometimes she didn't believe me. And, you know, so But we did develop this very strong relationship, and I do think I understood her emotions more, I think, because of my own experiences, and I think it did help her to know that I had been through something.
But interestingly, I mean, she and her family are people of faith, and you even went to a faith healing. She really was suffering because of her mom and wanting to know information, and I guess learning some of this stuff was pretty disturbing, pretty upsetting. Goes to this faith healing, ritual ceremony. I was searching for the right word there, and you were there essentially taking notes. What happened?
Yeah, it was an amazing sort of moment because we didn't even go to a faith healing. We were just sort of sitting in a room, and it spontaneously happened. So it was just and what happened was, you know, this sort of laying on of hands, and. You know, the man who did it was sort of screaming and saying, you know, Lord, you get to take the burden of the sales from this woman. She can't take them anymore. And I was sitting there scribbling notes. And then he, at a certain point, said, you know, you've got to give them to her. And he, you know, put his hands on my head. And that was actually, it was a big moment in my life in general, in the book. You know, as you said earlier, I have no religious background. I am a science person, and, you know, this was a very, a foreign world to me, and I spent a lot of time just trying to understand Deborah's beliefs and reading the Bible for the first time and going to church with her, and, you know, in that moment, I watched the utter relief that happened for her. I over all the years we were together, I never saw her let go of her fear and her pain in the way that she did in that moment. It was just the most astonishing thing I think I've ever seen.
And the experience of having it, quote unquote, transferred to you.
Yeah. And, you know, and what that transfer to me meant, it meant something very different for me than it did for her. You know, it was a sort of, for me, it was a symbolic transfer. For her, it was an actual literal transfer. And that was the moment where I had been really resisting being in the book at all. I'm in the book as a character. She and I travel around together, and I have issues with writers who put themselves in books. I teach writing, and I often say to my students, you know, it's not about you. You don't put yourself in every story.
Uh-oh.
And, you know, I always say you need to be in there for a reason. You know, only if you are actually a character who has some sort of role in the story and you've actually affected the story in some way. And a lot of people had been saying, you know, you have to be in this book. Like, all this stuff that's going on with you and Deborah really illustrates her experience with this and the families. And I kept saying, no, it's not about me. It's their story. And, you know, soon after that moment, one of the things that sort of moment taught me was that I sort of had no choice but to be in the book, because all of that stuff was happening because of me. You know, the struggle she was going through, the fact that she was having, you know, a very dangerous sort of physiologic reaction to learning some of this information. It was pretty traumatizing for her at points, you know, and I put her there. I put her in the labs, you know, where she learned about the cells. So, you know, me being in the book was part of dealing with that, sort of the ethics of that.
And the HeLa cells today, I know from reading the book that there are some problems with some of these cells.
Yeah.
And I guess not surprisingly, does this happen after 60 years?
Well, so there are a couple different things. And one of them is, you know, the cells have sort of mutated just like anything else, you're growing in different places. They've mutated and changed. And so there are a lot of different lines of HeLa. They're still they're still similarly useful to science. So it's not, that hasn't caused a problem. In some ways it's good because it's given them more different strains to study. The problem that they caused was that, soon after the HeLa cells grew, scientists basically took the same techniques and started growing libraries of cells, lots of different cells, prostate, breast, whatever. And it actually turned out that they were almost all HeLa cells, that HeLa cells can float on dust particles and on unwashed hands. And if they get into another culture dish, they just take over because they're so sort of powerful. So they had caused millions of dollars in damage and by contaminating things. And that's still a problem today. HeLa contamination is still pretty rampant in labs.
Let me get to Josie from, looks like West Philadelphia to join our conversation. Josie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
I
was just wondering if in your research, scientists have been able to explain why Henrietta Lacks cells were so special and able to multiply in this way and survive.
Thanks, Josie.
Yeah, not really. It's interesting. There are several different theories, and you know, one of them, she did have HPV, which caused her cervical cancer. And that can cause, you know, cells to grow, but so did a lot of people, and no, you know, their cells didn't just sort of take off like that. The syphilis that she had that can weaken your immune system and potentially also interact with the HPV and cause something to grow more quickly. That also was pretty common at the time. Mm-hmm. So there are certain things we know. We know that there's an enzyme in HeLa cells that rebuilds the ends of their chromosomes, so they don't really age like normal cells. But lots of cancer cells have that. And that's sort of the mechanism by which they stay alive. But why they do that is still, it's still a bit of a mystery.
That's interesting. Josie, thanks for the call. Let me get Michelle from Phoenixville to join our conversation. And Michelle, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I wanted to ask your guest what kind of effect Henrietta Lacks's case and story has had on giving patients consent when perhaps their cells are used. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Michelle. Yeah, go ahead, Rebecca.
Yeah, well, so far, none. It definitely seems to be spurring a lot of conversation, so I won't be surprised if things do sort of start to shift there. You know, there's been a lot of discussion for many years now, decades, about how to handle this issue of consent. People often say, oh, well, this could never happen today. But in fact, it happens every day. Pretty much everyone in the U.S. has their tissues on file somewhere being used in research. The big difference is that our names aren't usually associated with them, so they're anonymized. Mm. You know, but you go to the doctor to get a biopsy, you sign something that says my doctor can dispose of this any way he or she sees fit or use it in research, and this is what that means. It goes for this research. Every infant born in the U.S. since the 1960s, it's been mandatory by law to test to do a fetal blood sample where they test for genetic diseases, which is a good thing. You know, we've saved lots of lives that way, but those samples are often stored. People don't realize it. And
bought and sold?
Yeah.
Research?
Absolutely, yeah. They're used in research. They're commercialized. All of this stuff is pretty much. And so there's been this sort of bubbling debate for years where a lot of policymakers, ethicists, some scientists, a lot of patients' rights advocates are saying, hey, you know, people need to know this is happening. You know, yes, they gave consent they signed that thing, but nobody really knows what that means, and nobody knows, very few people know about the potential commercial side of it, and there have been some pretty big lawsuits that have come out of this where people have realized that their tissues were being used. One guy whose cells were patented and worth billions of dollars sued his doctor.
Did he win?
No. So far, the courts have ruled that patients don't have control over their tissues. Except just a few weeks ago, actually, a court in Texas, some families sued over their children's fetal blood samples being stored without their consent. And that court ruled in favor of the family, which I think is pretty big. So the state of Texas just had to destroy 5.3 million samples collected from kids without their parents' consent. So there does seem to be a big shift going on right now. And, you know, and the big thing, scientists, you know, this is a scary thing for scientists. There's a big concern that people are going to start hearing about this and understanding more about tissue research, and then they're going to start holding out on their tissues or demanding that things be destroyed or trying to negotiate for money, and that this is going to interfere with science. And so I think the big thing right now is trying to figure out a way to say, okay, people clearly want to know, that they want to be asked if it's okay for their tissues to be used in research. Some people want to say no, mm-hmm. because their religious mm-hmm. beliefs or whatever. But for the most part, people will say yes. They just want to know the facts. And so I think that conversation is probably coming.
Do you think, though, that signed, because this book, and this book has done so well, that scientists are worried that this kind of research could get shut down? But what you're saying is that if people want to know. Mm-hmm. I mean, in today's world, people want to know things. And if you know, chances are
you'll say yes.
You'll say yes. You'll give permission.
I've talked to pretty much everyone involved in everyone who's still alive who's been involved in any legal case really surrounding the ownership of tissues. I've talked to them at some point, and across the board, you know, their cases in the courts focus on money usually. Some of them focus on consent, but mostly it's about the money. And across the board, they've said to me, if they had just asked, I would have said yes. Like, this would not have been an issue. But when they find out after the fact, then they find out there's commercialization, and they feel very deceived and taken advantage of. And so a lot of this, I really do think, comes down to just needing to develop some sort of uniform practices for consent and having there be some kind of probably federal, you know, requirement that says you have to get consent. Different institutions have different practices. So there are some institutions where you'll go in and you'll get a book, you know, that tells you all about tissue research, and it tells you, you know, we're going to use your tissues for this or that, or maybe not this, and they'll give you different options. And then there's other places that you don't even know. So there's
something
no standard.
Uniform would be helpful. We're almost out of time here, but I just want to go back to Henrietta Lacks's family, and she did have a daughter named Elsie.
Yeah.
And Elsie was sent to, it wasn't the final name of this hospital, a state hospital, but it was called the Hospital for the Negro Insane. And she died there at the age of 15. And you took Deborah there, and you looked at a photograph and also, I guess, an autopsy right, of Elsie.
That was one of the... Sometimes people often ask me, what was the most surprising thing that you found in this book? And it was definitely that moment. So Deborah had a sister who, when Henrietta was, when she was pregnant with her fifth child and she was just developing this cancer, Elsie, who was her oldest daughter, she was epileptic and she was deaf and mute, most likely because of syphilis, because her parents had syphilis. And she was in Henrietta's doctor basically convinced her that she had to institutionalize Elsie. And so she was sent to this place that was, it used to be called the Home for Crazy Negroes. And it turned out that it was a horribly barbaric place. And it was like a lot of mental institutions, particularly, in the South where black patients were in the 50s. It was a pretty horrific place, really overcrowded.
Snake bit idea.
Yeah, and, people sleeping one on top of the other and a lot of abuse. And, so one of the things that Deborah said when she finally said, okay, I'll talk to you, and I said, I will share information with you, she said, there are, two things you have to promise me. One is that you're going to tell me everything that you find out about my mother, and two is you're going to figure out what happened to my sister.
Awesome.
Because she had this feeling that something bad had happened, and no one ever talked about it. So we did end up going to this hospital, and the whole story was sort of shocking. We stumbled on this information about what happened to her, and she was used in some pretty awful research without anyone's knowledge. And it was sort of another another generation of Lacks used in research. And Deborah was with me when I was learning this, so this was this moment when I couldn't sort of filter it for her.
Well, I hate to end on that note, but Rebecca Skloot, I thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. And again, congratulations on your book.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. I actually lost track of time there. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. And the book is called The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. Stay with us.